give me a signal, because I'd rather not use the mic, if that's okay. Oh, but do I have to be here? Or can I be here?
Is she
good right there? What? Can you hear on the Zoom? Oh. Yep. Oh, good. That is a very close camera, I'm just here to say. But who's worried about her wrinkles? Not me. So it's really wonderful to be here with you. I have a little agenda. Can you read it? Like, I'm realizing I think I need glasses too. What I'm going to tell you a little bit about first is our story, and then just some nuggets I learned from, or and am learning from that story. And then I kind of want to move into more of my work with Project Belong, and sort of some of the need worldwide, all the way down to Arlington, and our call to radical hospitality, and tell you a little bit more about Project Belong, and then give you a chance to figure out if there might be a way that you might want to engage. And, you know, let me just say before I get started, like, when you hear foster care and adoption, like, how many of you, raise your hand if somewhere in your circle, right? So that might be a family member, that might be yourself, that might be a dear friend, has fostered. Great. How about adopted? Okay. So you know that, what about any of you? Okay. So you know probably a little bit more about the story, stories, because they touch you, right? And you also know that the people who do that kind of work are very special and over there. And so it would be really easy for you to hear that we're going to talk about foster care and adoption and a little bit check out, because maybe that's somebody else's call, but maybe not your call. And I just want to encourage you tonight to foster care and adoption is one of many ways that we can lean in to loving people who are vulnerable. Ryla is another. They're sort of the three-legged stool of the vulnerable, which is the widow and orphan, the immigrant, and the poor, right? And I just want, I hope tonight can be a little bit of illumination, particularly with vulnerable children, but also a way for you all to think about, how do you want to lean in with hospitality? Because I think that the work Ryla does, the work that Project Belong does, and many other of the ministries that you all are probably involved with, is all about hospitality. And some radical hospitality, but it's looking to the other. And so I hope that you can hear some of the things that we're going to talk about through that lens, instead of, sometimes I feel like I walk down the hall and people are like, the foster care lady, the foster care lady. So we don't want to do that. So let me tell you a little bit about our story. This is my little fam. And I had, when we moved here, to start Emmanuel, it was just a fabulous and fun adventure. And at that time, I was homeschooling. We've done a little bit of everything. We've homeschooled. We've gone to Rivendell School. We've gone to public school. So lots of different school paths in our story. And at that time, I happened to be homeschooling, and I was part of a homeschool group. And at that homeschool group were two people. One in particular that I would always try and nudgle up near. And ask all sorts of questions, because she would come in with medically fragile babies. And so every couple of months, she would have a new baby. And her name is Boo Perkins. And I said, Boo, how? I would be the one who asked her 40 billion questions, you know? How can you give them back? What happens? You know, and that was kind of my first person that I knew who fostered. And that sort of lit something up within me. And I went home and talked to Scott about it. And he was like, you know what? Yeah, I'm actually really open to fostering, which I kind of fell on the floor, because usually that's not the case. Usually the women are sort of out front and sort of waiting for the men to come along. That's a very common theme. But he was not. And I think partly because we both have a strong belief in life and life beginning in the womb, but we wanted to also carry that forward all the way to the tomb. And so we felt like this foster care was a way to put legs on our deep value of life. And so that was sort of what got us both in agreement that we would like that. But then life was really busy, right? And so I was homeschooling, we were starting the church. It was a little bit, I was a little bit at my level. And so it kind of got backburnered. And it got backburnered for another little while because then I got a really neat job. And so it was backburnered again. And, but we always kind of thought about it. But then Scott and I decided, and I don't know if you're like this, but we decided we live just outside of Washington, D.C. There are all these neat intellectual things to do. We're not thinking about foster care, okay? We're just wanting to go on a date that's like kind of a D.C. intellectual date because we thought that would be cool and good for us, right? And so a friend of ours runs a think tank, and so she was launching a book that's called Unleashing Opportunity. And we thought, let's go support her at the launch of her book. That is a very cool intellectual date. And she had that, we did that at Georgetown. And I'm telling you, when we left that date, foster care was right on the front of our mind again. It was like God did a big lightning bolt. And, you know, that those are the kinds of things that happen every once in a while, and this was one of those times, and for both Scott and I. And sort of the short of it was, in this book, Unleashing Opportunity, they said, if you want to really affect poverty, get involved in one of these five areas, and one of those areas was foster care, because they could point to a lot of different statistics that, you know, 65 to 70% of kids who are trafficked are come out of the foster care system. You could just point to so many kids who age out of the foster care system, which means they sort of graduate and turn 18 and have no forever home. The statistics for those kids are abysmal. They're, you know, 79% are pregnant by the time that they're 20. And many of those children go into foster care. A third of them are homeless. Many never finish their GED, much less college education. So it was it was very compelling. So we left, and I proceeded to initiate having lunch with a friend of mine who I knew had just finished a fostering placement. I wanted to sort of pick her brain and talk about it because her kids are kind of were at the same stage as my kids. And at that point, Claire, my oldest, was in college, and my younger two, David was a junior in high school, and Audrey was a sophomore in high school. And so I wanted to talk to her about what about the kids, and how does it affect the kids, and all of that. So I told Scott, well, I'm getting together with this friend for lunch. And he said, well, is it okay if I come? And I was like, oh my gosh, that is crazy. Sure. Yes. And so that helped me know that he was really serious. And so we then just everything sort of fell into place. We went to the first Arlington meeting, and then we went to the 30-hour training, and we got all of the background checks and the case studies and all that stuff done. And then we signed the papers. And the next day at 2:30, I got a phone call. And I thought it was going to be a phone call just making sure that my oldest had one last shot, even though she didn't live at home, you know. And instead it was the call. And it was 2:30, and they said, well, we had told them that we would be open to keeping one child that was maybe 8 or below. And they said, we wonder if you could stretch a little bit. Could you keep two children, one who's 6 and one who's 11 months? And so I hung up, and I was, you know, out at a meeting, and it went to the answering machine, and so I was sitting in my car, and I called Scott, and I texted the fam, and we all decided, yes, we're ready. And so by 5 o'clock, that afternoon, we had a 6-year-old and an 11-month-old. I had no stuff. And because I'm part of a wonderful church and I was working at another wonderful church, I was able to just instantly have what we needed. We had those two kids for 2 years. The social worker said to us when she dropped them off, you have to know this is going to be a short placement. And 2 years later, the kids went to be adopted to a wonderful gal, and I think that their trajectory is going great. So that's a little bit of our story. And so what I wanted to do was tell you a few nuggets that I learned. Is there a trick? Do I just... Okay, so some of the nuggets that I learned, and I'm still learning, is that when you are a foster parent, your job is to be a bridge. And so I learned a lot about being a bridge and what that, how important that work is. But the nature of a bridge is that you get walked over by both sides, right? And so that was hard work, but it was beautiful work. And a lot of who you're building bridges to is to the biological family, because the biological family these days, it used to be that you were kept very separate, but now it's very much you are really an agent in helping the biological family be for them and succeed and helping them try and reunify with the child, because that's always the goal. And that happens about 40% of the time, either with the biological parent or a family member. So I learned a lot about being a bridge. I learned that I didn't think that I was judgy about parenting things. I thought that I was a pretty laid-back mom, right? I could roll with different parenting philosophies pretty well. And I think that was important to me as a pastor's wife, because I wanted anyone to come to our church with their different philosophies, and I wanted us to welcome each other. I didn't feel like there was a right way. So I guess I was a little bit proud in my non-prideness. I don't know what I was. It was sinful, whatever it was. But I learned that that needed to be stretched, because very often I would get to know this family and they would show love in very different ways, but the love was there. And I really learned to respect where the ways that they showed love that weren't the same ways that I showed love. And I love that I grew that way. Another one was that my definition of family was too small. When I think about family, I think about those people on the slide, and then my parents and my brother and my aunt and uncle and Scott's parents, and that's who I think about. But through these kids and through getting to know their biological family, I learned that family can be a lot bigger than what my narrow view of it was. And these kids had a very rich definition of family. Sometimes it could be a little bit chaotic, because it was like, okay, how is that person related? You know, but it was beautiful nonetheless. And so I very much grew that way. And, you know, it reminded me, because a lot of friends, we have a lot of State Department friends that go overseas and know a lot of different overseas folks. And what happens in some cultures is children call dear friends of the family auntie and uncle. And I love that, because I feel like that's kind of what I learned more to do in my own home with these kids and with their family. And then I also learned, probably this wasn't as hard of a lesson, that the county isn't meant to be the family. The church can be the family, but the county is not meant to be the family. We need the county because the work that they do is very important. And the church has a little bit abdicated a lot, and so the county has to do a lot, and they have good good workers, and they have to do hard, hard work. But they're not family. They're the government, right? And so we need families to provide home. And that is what's really convicting is when the church chooses not to be family, right? And when we choose not to lean into that hospitality. Another nugget that I learned was that the effects of trauma on children are deep, deep. And so if you have any interaction with kids who've been through trauma, you have to know that they can't just sit still or behave or keep the daggum job. It's very difficult because some of the grit that maybe you and I grew up with, of our mom telling us to eat the green beans and to do our homework, that has been very chaotic in a lot of these kids' lives. And so having parents and friends and teachers and Sunday school teachers that understand the deep effects of trauma is really important because these kids are everywhere. They're in the Arlington school. We have 77 kids in Arlington who are in foster care. And so they're, you know, friends of, I don't know how old your kids are, but they're here right with us. And so the effects of trauma are really, really deep. It's interesting because some children with their response to trauma, their propensity is to be the perfect child so they can earn love. And that, I've noticed, is very easy to parent. And then on the other side, you can have a child be very, very angry and very, very emotional. And that is very hard to parent. And I had both in my house. I had a perfect little angel baby, and I had an angry, angry little one. And so that was hard. I would say another nugget is just how much I don't know about other races and other socioeconomic, you know, I grew up kind of middle class. I'm still middle class. And I think sometimes the differences racially and the differences socioeconomically, which can be both, and in our case were, there's so much to learn. And so I would just really encourage us all to lean into being a learner about other socioeconomic groups and some of the challenges that they face, and also other race issues. There were some things that I understood for the first time in real life that were only intellectual concepts to me, like just racial inequity. I understood that conceptually, but I saw it when these kids were in my home. And so that was hard, but it was also good. I'm glad I'm a different person because of that. I'm a better person because of seeing some of those differences. Another was that I needed help, but I didn't ask for help. And it was a very subtle, I didn't mean for it to be, but it was a very subtle form of pride, but not in the, oh, I don't need help kind of way. More in the, I'm used to helping everybody. And so it was, I didn't really think ahead enough to get help. And so that was the way I feel like I wish I did better, because I think I robbed the people of Emmanuel of getting to know the children better, which they would be better people if they knew the children and the family better. And so I will be better about that. But my personality is one that, you know, I tend to say yes to too much anyway, and then I'm not 6 steps out. I'm kind of right there, and I was working full-time and doing churchy things, and, you know, I wasn't ahead enough. And I'll be honest with you, Emmanuel was great. Emmanuel was so proud of us. I felt like Emmanuel was praying for us, but Emmanuel didn't know how to step in and help us because I wasn't asking. And you know, we've all been in that situation where you're like, okay, I can tell that she's looking a little like flustered, but I'm not sure exactly what to do. And so let me just encourage you, if you know someone who's fostering or doing that hard thing, maybe it's taking care of an aging parent, maybe it's step in and do the uncomfortable thing and ask, what do you need for me to do today? And that might even be a hard question. I had a hard time knowing how to answer that. So, but lean in and don't wait for them to ask you. Another nugget was that this experience had an amazing impact on my bio kids. Amazing impact. It was hard. It still is hard. I just got a phone call from Audrey, who had a class in college about race, and she was calling me and bawling about the kids not being in our home and, you know, the situation. But it's also very much impacted what she wants to do for a career. I think it was amazing for my son. It was amazing for my daughter, who didn't live with us because of a lot of different reasons that I'd love to tell you more about. But a lot of people that I've talked to have a real fear of, how will this impact my kids? Will they be okay? And it's really good for our kids who live here in Arlington and have a lot of privilege to see that the world is not like that, even right here in Arlington. You don't have to go to Guatemala to find poverty. And I don't just mean financial poverty. You know, I mean poverty of family and poverty of all the different types of poverty. So it was really, really impactful on my kids. I think another nugget was that I was very humbled. I don't want to be a judgy person realm. But I did kind of have an idea of what my parenting philosophy was, right? I mean, I don't know that I followed it, but I'd raised three kids, right? And a lot of the credit for them being me goes to them because they made great choices. But I think because they were older, I kind of felt like I knew how to parent. And I really realized how much I didn't know. And that was such a humbling place to be. But that's such a good place to be. I mean, my pride doesn't like it, but boy, I have never repented more. And this is like, you know, here's a vulnerable child in my home who's been through trauma, and yet I'm impatient with him because he's scratching and biting me, and I'm frustrated with him. And I, the adult, who's raised kids, can't have the patience to understand his difficult situation. I mean, it was just very, very humbling to think, oh my word, Chris, you know, come on, of anybody, this could be the person that you would have the most patience for, but I was so done with it, right? So it was a very humbling place to be, but a very good place to be. And then God uses and redeems your story. And that will be in ways that you might not ever expect, and in timing that you might not ever expect. And that's kind of what leads me into the sort of next piece. And that's talking more about, a little bit more about Project Belong. I want us to talk a little bit about the need. I'm a little bit nervous because this is, well, let me, sorry, I'm getting distracted by what is looking like a, anyway. Okay, so, sorry, the need. So across the world, there are 153 million orphans. That's the population of Russia, okay, are orphans. 440,000 children, that's if you take the national stadium and you fill it with children 11 times. That's how many children are in foster care in the U.S. Right here in Virginia, we have about 5,500. And that is the total student body at Christopher Newport, is how many kids are in foster care in Virginia. Here in Northern Virginia, in the metro northern, metro D.C. area, is about 550. That's the number of times love is mentioned in the Bible. Right here in Arlington County, about 77 kids in foster care. And in that same county, Arlington County, we have about 80 churches, right? In Northern Virginia, we have 600 plus, easy, way more than 600 churches. So the math, okay, this number is very intimidating. I just want to check out, right? But this number, with 600 churches, the math works, right? If just one church has one person that engages, the problem isn't solved because there's going to be brokenness until heaven, right? But you can have the gospel and the hope of believers being into the system. That feels doable. You know, LA County alone has 30,000 children in foster care. So we're privileged here. Now, in the whole tip of Northern Virginia, our numbers go way up. In the Winchester area, if you add that whole area in, there's about 1,300 kids in foster care. But the numbers are scary, but they're doable. And we have to, I think, look at those numbers as not just numbers, but souls, but little people, right, who are vulnerable, not because of any choice that they made. So
leads us to James 1:27, where it says, religion that is pure and undefiled before God, the Father resists to visit orphans and widows.
Yeah, let me just introduce it really quick. Sorry. So this is a colleague, Jason Johnson, and he's part of an organization called CAFO, which is Christian Alliance for Orphans. And that's kind of an umbrella group that a lot of organizations like mine are a part of. And he is speaking about James 1:27. And we're part of a network called the 1:27 Network because of James. And so I'm going to let Jason, in his masterful way, unpack what James 1:27 means. So now.
Leads us to James 1:27, where it says, religion that is pure and undefiled before God, the Father resists to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained by the world. You know, this is an interesting verse because it's often referred to as a command, as a mandate, when in fact it's actually really not. There's no command. This verse isn't telling us to do anything. It's actually describing something for us. It's describing something really beautiful for us. And so let's pick it apart just real, real quick here. Here's what it's describing for us. This is seminary, by the way. You take really fine verses, and you mark them up and X them out, and it's a lot of fun. And here's why, because it just helps us to see underneath the surface of what we're reading. So that word religion there isn't our word religion. It's not like cathedrals and steeples. This word religion literally means an outward display of something that's inwardly true. And that's what we're talking about here, an outward display of the gospel, which is inwardly true in us. And so James is now describing one of the purest and most undefiled outward displays of the gospel that this world will ever see. You want to put the gospel on display with great vividness and clarity and purity? Then visit or move, step towards, get involved with. This is a hard one. Because the world we live in says, avoid hard and broken things at all costs. Insulate yourself from them. Isolate yourself from them. Move across town. Structure a life where you can live out the rest of your days pretending like hard and broken things do not exist. And then James says, how about we be a people who move and step towards and get involved with the most vulnerable in our society. He uses orphans and widows, again, as representatives, as descriptives of that. Because in his culture, orphans and widows, the husbandless and the fatherless, were considered to be the most worthless. And so he's using them in really a profound way. If you were the audience of James at that time, and you heard James say, one of the purest and most undefiled ways for us to put the work of God on display is to get involved with orphans and widows, there would be a collective gasp in the room. What? Really? Them? Them? Yes. The most vulnerable in our society. That's our people. That's where we go. That's where the gospel is put on display with a vividness and a purity unlike anything else. And so we could argue very easily that homelessness and incarceration and trafficking and the struggling neighbor across the street, if we were to go to James and say, James, you didn't mention any of them, he would say, yes, I did. This is representative of the most vulnerable in society, that we would be a people who move and step towards and get involved with them. Because when we do that, it puts the work of Jesus on display in pure and undefiled ways. So the applications of this, the implications of this are pretty clear. That one of the purest and most undefiled demonstrations of the gospel is to see hard places and broken people and move towards them, not away from them. This is what James 1:27 is suggesting. That you and I would become the kind of people that say, I see you where you are, and I'm coming after you. And when we do that, people around us say, gosh, why are you doing that? You're supposed to insulate and isolate. Why are you doing that? Why are you purposely stepping into hard and broken places? Why would you do that? Your family will look at you like you're crazy. Your friends will look at you like you're crazy. Your mother-in-law will look at you like you're crazy, right? You'll look in the mirror sometimes and say, hey, you're crazy. What are you doing? And you're right, it's crazy. It's crazy that God would do this for us. And it's crazy that he would then invite us and give us the privilege to step in and do the same for others. It's crazy.
Awesome. So that sort of leads to this idea of hospitality and radical hospitality. And because of time, in the questions for the discussion time, I included these quotes. So I'm going to let you, I would highly recommend both of these books because one is by Rosaria Butterfield and it's called The Gospel with a House Key. And she has an amazing story, but she also opens her home like no one I've ever known before. And another one is by Dustin Willis. And again, just that idea of leaning in and being radically hospitable. And so it might not be with fostering, or it might be. So let me tell you a little bit about Project Belong, and then we can let you get to your breakout groups. We believe in Project Belong, that every child belongs in a family. You know, it's really cool how science is really proving. In the last 10 years, there's all this great brain work that's being studied about how important it is for kids to grow up in the context of a family with adults that love them, that they can attach to. And so everything that we do drives that. And what we want to do is find, inspire, recruit, and resource more than enough people in local churches to provide homes through being a foster family, home through being an adopted family, and wraparound care to those foster, adoptive, and biological families that are struggling. So that's our mission, is to help the church really dig in and love these children well. What we do is we go into churches and we help them look internally to say, okay, how are we doing? Do we have anyone here in our congregation that's fostering or adopting them? Are we taking care of them well? Do we have children's ministries that are trauma-informed that can I've talked to so many foster parents who have said the church on Sunday morning is the hardest place for us to go because we're not all buttoned up. And so Project Belong wants to help equip the church to welcome those more difficult cases. And then we want to help churches look out into their community and to serve the counties that they're in and to serve the agencies that are doing the hard work. It might be by providing a foster parents' night out, or Cherrydale has been great at helping with a lot of different things, because Cherrydale has a really neat orphan care ministry, but providing some gift baskets for foster families, or the ability for the county to meet here and have their meetings here. So right now we're working in Fairfax, Arlington, Alexandria, and Loudoun counties, and we're hopeful that this year we'll add on Prince William as well. So for you, what's next for hospitality? It might be that you are curious to know more about fostering, and I would love to chat with you. Find me, and I'll give you a card, and we can have coffee or chat over the Zoom. I would love to encourage you to pray. I would love to encourage you to think about giving to Project Belong or any other ministry that helps you lean in. Ryla is another great one. Or go. So we have a monthly prayer letter. If you want to sign up for that, you can go to our website and pray with us. We would love for you to give, because to do the work we do, we don't go into churches and charge them. We raise our support from individuals. And going, there's so many ways to get involved, so many ways. And so I would really just encourage you. I would love to talk to you about some of the ways, and if you have any questions about any of it, I would love to do my best to find the answer if I don't have it. So, with that, my story, a little bit of Project Belong's story, and just an encouragement to you to lean into radical hospitality. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Chris. That was really great to hear parts of your story. And I'm going to email more information about Ryla, and then I'm also going to send some information about this, because I know we've got